Welcome to Making and Breaking Social Policy, a podcast about how we respond to big social issues and what this means for social and community practice. My name is Ben Lohmeyer, and I am a lecturer and researcher in social work at Flinders University. Today's special guest is Dr. Joel McGregor, and we are going to have a conversation about a paper we wrote together on youth case management. Joel is a lecturer and discipline convener of criminology at Swinburne University. He completed his PhD in 2019, which examined how case management and diversionary programs, such as rehabilitation interventions, come together as a practice to help young people get back on their feet following involvement with juvenile justice. Joel's research is uncovering the complex relational practices that make up a case manager's day-to-day work. For instance, case managers will often relate to their clients firstly through their own experiences of trauma or criminality, then secondly, they'll bring in what they have learned from their training. Joel is also co-investigator and criminology consultant expert on a fledgling pilot program called Name, Narrate, and Navigate. This cross-disciplinary project helps young people name the place of violence in their lives. In the paper we published together and this chat today, we compare two case management programs, one in South Australia called Flexible Learning Options and under the Department for Education, and the other in New South Wales called the Joint Support Program under the Department for Communities and Justice. We take a close look at the policies surrounding them that dictate the young person to case management ratios, the qualifications and reporting requirements for case managers, and consider the implications that this has for the education and conditions for case managers and the young people that they work with. We recognise that Flinders Social Work operates on the traditional lands and waters of the Kaurna peoples. We pay respect to elders past, present and emerging. We acknowledge their sovereignty and continued responsibility to care for country. Joel, thank you so much for joining me for this conversation.
Thanks, Ben. So I'm joining you on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people, the Kulin Nation. And I have to say, during this lockdown, I'm really grateful for the Wurundjeri people protecting this land, as I can enjoy the beautiful Yarra River during the lockdown and the surrounds of the Yarra River as well.
Oh, that's great. Thanks, man. Yeah, it's important to note, I think, that we're recording this during another phase of lockdown here in both in South Australia where I am, but Victoria where you are as well. So it's pretty lucky to be able to do this kind of stuff and continue in our jobs and do a Teams interview to make this happen. There may be some noise and things in the background at my place because I've got some kids around as well, so we'll see how that works out. But let's talk about this paper that we recently published. It's titled A Critical Examination of Australian Youth Case Management, The Compounding Governing Spaces and Infantilizing Self-Management. You know, it's not a good sign when you can't even pronounce your own title, but we got there. So that was in the Journal of Youth Studies. So in not at all a self-serving way, I thought we should maybe just chat about it a little bit more. So thanks for having this chat. Before we talk about the paper, let's step back just a little bit. You and I met at a sociology conference a number of years ago, and we discovered we had this shared interest in youth case management. Can you tell us a little bit about, from your perspective, how did this project come about?
Yeah, so I guess we were both completing our PhDs at the time. And it seems so long ago now, I can't remember, but I would say probably how it did come about is we saw commonalities in our work, albeit in kind of different areas. But I'm sure I would have went, this guy seems nerdy and cool, and I deal with nerdy and cool, so let's work together.
Nice. Interesting combination. Yeah, great.
I mean, should I assume that? But anyway, we'll stick with that.
You've got to go with those assumptions at the start. Absolutely. Yeah. No, that's great. Okay. So a little meeting of the minds, which was great. We found some commonalities in our project. Can you tell us just a little bit more about your PhD project? Because I want to hear some more about your approach to case management, and then I'll talk a little bit about mine as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, look, my PhD was in sociology, and I should say as well, I'm not a practitioner. And, you know, while I've done some volunteer work and I've done some practice work since my PhD, I did go into it from a more theoretical perspective. So my PhD drew on interdisciplinary work, particularly in the field of governmentality studies, and also drew on policy and practice frameworks, and really looked at how these come to bear on the pathways of young people desisting from crime. And I guess the key thing about this thesis which often gets confused, and it may be due to my own poor explanation of the thesis. But this PhD was about the workers and the programs, and it wasn't really about the young people. What it was about was how the practitioners bring their knowledges to their work and how it influences the programs that they run. And I should also say that I never set out to do the PhD on this topic, but, you know, through a changing circumstances, that's how it came about. And I'm really glad it did, because I really enjoyed this work.
So yeah, that's great. Thanks, man.
That's all
tell
right.
Tell us some more.
Yeah, so the research identified some really conflicting ways in which case management and diversionary programs come together and are applied in the youth justice setting. Conflicting might be a bit strong of wording, but we'll get into that in a moment. So what I exposed, or what I found, was that practitioners drew upon their personal understandings of young people to undertake their work. So I would say that they drew upon these more so rather than the practices or institutionally recognized knowledges, such as their degrees or, you know, diplomas or what be it. So, for example, I would argue that practitioners do case management through their own subjectivities and the subjectivities that they imagine for their clients. And I'll give some examples of that in a second. However, what I would say is that practitioners had to strategically negotiate relationships between, for example, themselves, their funding body, or themselves and their clients. So
that makes sense.
Three classic examples that I give. One, first of all, is a practitioner that told me that they had and what they termed as relative success in the business world. Mm. And subsequently, they could bring this to their work. Another practitioner had a background in makeup and beauty, and again, in their words, said that they could teach their young female clients about deportment. Problematic as that is, and, you know, we could have a large conversation about that.
Yeah, we could.
Another was a mum who said she had successfully raised her kids and now wanted to give back to the community. And I should say as well, all of these practitioners had, you know, recognised institutional qualifications, but really emphasised these histories that they brought to their work. And actually, lastly, there was a practitioner also who had a brother who was currently in juvenile justice and had quite a traumatic history and upbringing, and said that they bring that to their work. Mm. But really, what I witnessed when I was talking to these practitioners about their work is that while they emphasized these aspects of themselves over formal qualifications, when I prodded them further, they tended to downplay how they actually brought this to their work. So they would say to me, yep, you know, I'm a mum, I've successfully raised my kids. And I'd say, okay, well, you know, how do you actually bring that to work, your work? And they wouldn't be able to articulate or say that they could acknowledge these facets of their subjectivities to their clients. And so, while I don't think there's, you know, anything necessarily wrong with this, and I understand why they didn't, I did see a really interesting, I've lost my words, thing happen here where they were making up their practice through their own subjectivities but not being able to actually acknowledge it. So not doing some of that really critical work around practice.
Yeah, wow.
So what I argue, and I guess how we also came to be working together as well, is that while this diversity in practice really contributed to the richness of case management programs, it also meant that there were ethical considerations when working with young people in desisting from crime that relocated critical reflection, and really, I would argue, probably didn't allow for critical reflection. So I guess what I was doing in my thesis was really advocating for new conceptual frameworks to investigate how the service delivery of youth case management and assistance could be understood within the youth justice framework.
I mean, every time you talk about this, I pick up on a little bit that I haven't really picked up on before. And I think one of the things that stands out to me this time is that distinction that you're making between we're talking about youth case management, but we're actually almost more talking about the case managers than the young people. And there are kind of effects that we'll talk about later for the young people, but it's the case managers themselves that are kind of in focus here. And I find it really interesting that you're talking about the case manager's subjectivities, or another way of my saying that's probably their sense of identity and who they are, that really comes through in their work over some of their qualifications. And one of the things I was thinking about is, you know, you and I come to this moment in kind of different perspectives. Like you said, you haven't been a practitioner, you're more theoretical in that sense, whereas my background was as a practitioner. And so in the policy framework or in the service that we are analysing, so I was working as a flow case manager when I was doing my PhD and left that to keep going into academia. And part of my experience is kind of seeing in anecdotal ways the stuff that you're describing, you know, the seeing these practitioners live out that identity rather than necessarily their framework. The other bit, though, that kind of motivated me to get into this, which comes through in the things that we look at as well, is not only that identity, personal identity being something that forms practice, but there are other structures around organizational and social and policy structures that influence the practitioner's work as well. So what I saw was, and this kind of motivated me to do my research, was that these practice frameworks, you know, principles for good practice, were being compromised by business imperatives and business needs. So you got these practitioners working in NGOs, and the NGO needs that bucket of money. For a lot of really good reasons, right? Like, you've got to pay staff and you've got to have an organization. But that means that we're willing to kind of compromise a little bit on best practice principles so that we can get that contract with that school or get that bucket of money for a funding body of some sort. So that was the part of the conversation for me as well that was really interesting. And I think this paper kind of brings those together in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know, like, even, you know, one of the people who I interviewed, one of the practitioners, said to me outright, organizations become really good at report writing, and this compromises the care that they have for young people. And, you know, that was a really telling moment for me. And it was almost surprising, actually, that I think she was so candid in the way that she told me that. Because I think some of the, you know, when we did talk about funding requirements or requirements of the program, or, you know, all of those kind of neoliberal requirements, practitioners were less willing to kind of share their thoughts or views on that.
Okay.
So it was surprising to me that she was so candid in that moment.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. As I suppose one of the privileges of getting to do this kind of research, people tell you things they might not otherwise tell other people. We should give a little bit more context, though, for what we're talking about. So there was two policy frameworks that we looked at and compared. So we're talking about youth case management, but both of these policy frameworks have youth case management in them. One is called the acronyms. Again, we live in an acronym space. There's JSP. That's where you started looking at your PhD. And then I was looking at Flow. Tell us a little bit about JSP, and then I'll talk a little bit about Flow.
Yeah, definitely. So JSP is a youth case management program. And I should say as well that not all of the organizations or practitioners working within my PhD were part of JSP, but obviously we brought that program to this paper. So it's a youth case management program which aims to reduce recidivism among young people who are at a medium to high risk of offending. So the New South Wales Department of Justice funds JSP, and it really targets young people 16 to 18 year olds who are under supervision in the community. So it's a partnership program, and it aims to be a continuum of the support provided by juvenile justice. So targeted, as I said, at young people who have been at risk of being entrenched in the criminal justice system. So it's an outcome-based referral system where the service provider works with the client to achieve targets which they have specified in their case plan. So these targets are pretty varied. It can be things like housing, it can be things like repairing relationships. And it runs for 12 weeks. So a single caseworker is expected to help the young person for around a 12-month period.
Great. Okay. That's really good. Yeah, I find that little last bit that you said as well interesting. It's a 12-week program, but they're supposed to work with the young person for about 12 months. So there's this like re-referral process going on there. But I think we'll come back and talk about that a little
bit more. Absolutely will. And that was probably a slip of the tongue as well.
No, that's fine. All good. All right. So in comparison, the FLOW program or Flexible Learning Options is a South Australian alternative education program. So it is funded by the Department of Education and funded through public secondary schools in South Australia. And essentially, you know, oversimplification of what happens is, you know, student gets enrolled in secondary school and they have two options. They can be a normal enrollment or what's called a global enrollment sometimes. And the school gets a certain amount of money based on the number of students they have. Alternatively, if that student is struggling to engage for any range of factors, they can be flow enrolled. And so instead of going into a standard secondary school, the school is able to take a smaller bucket of money and use that to purchase services for that young person to give them a more flexible pathway. And this happens in a range of different ways. Sometimes it's like an internal alternative education program, sometimes it's an external one. But one of the main key elements of the program is that the young person receives case management. And usually that is, actually, I think it's a requirement. It has to be a non-school based person. So they go to an NGO, a non-government organization, and they employ a case manager to come and work with that young person. And so the young person receives a weekly case management service. It's usually for about an hour with the case manager. And it's a year-long service provision, but usually it goes longer than that, but it's, you know, a yearly contract if you like. And the service is provided 52 weeks of the year. So that's kind of the setup. It's government funded, again, through a department, kind of like yours, goes through schools, then is outsourced to non-government service providers to provide the case management. But within those two programs, we looked at some, again, sort of more specific policy details. There's key elements that we're looking at across what were they? They were the ratios, case management ratios, then the qualifications of the case management and the reporting requirements that we had required in each of those. So we kind of drilled right down and looked at those. So what were the similarities and differences between these case management services? So can you tell us a little bit about what some of those requirements were for JSP?
Yeah, absolutely. So my slip of the tongue before, let's set the record straight there. So the program JSP runs for 12 weeks and a case manager is expected to provide a service to a total of 16 people in a 12-month period. However, what we found when we did drill down into the kind of nitty-gritty of it was that a young person can be re-enrolled in the service at the end of the 12 weeks. So, and this re-enrollment counts as a new referral. So it's possible that a young person can be re-enrolled four times a year and that a case manager could conceivably work with only four young people in a 12-month period. So that's kind of clearing up that 12-month anomaly that I gave before. And I will say that I did see this in services as well, in the services that I worked with. And it wasn't only re-enrolling young people in the same program. If an NGO had multiple programs, they would talk about shutting them down in one program and opening them up in another in order to continue to work with them for a longer period of time. And I think we can kind of, you know, we can talk about that in relation to what neoliberal social policy allows us to do. What are the creative ways that practitioners can work with young people and what service do young people actually need?
Yeah, that's great. I like that framing because it's not just about that being good or bad for a practice or re-rolling, but there's some interesting frameworks around that or influences that we should think about. So that's cool. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think as well, And sorry, I will get back to the conversation, but I've been rethinking about some of my PhD data that I found and re-looking and re-analyzing and working out what actually or how we can think about that in a theoretical way. And at the moment, I'm thinking about it as a form of positive deviance.
Ah, okay. Tell us more. What do you mean?
It's like deviance against kind of the neoliberal framework, but it's deviance for a positive outcome.
Yeah, okay.
And I need to do a lot more kind of thinking about that. But, you know, as with most things, we always go back to our data and look at it and think about different ways of framing it and that kind of thing. So, yeah, maybe a watch this space for that one.
Yeah, nice. Okay, I'm looking forward to a conversation or a paper from you about positive deviance. That'll be great.
But look, back to what we had a look at. So in the JSP, case support workers are expected to attend regular meetings with the department and the young person to establish targets and discuss processes towards the outcomes that they had set. Workers were expected to submit 6 weekly and exit reports for each young person and attend other meetings as they were required. NGOs were required to meet quarterly with an area manager to discuss their service delivery report. And what we found was that the meeting regime within JSP appeared to be set by quite a strict agenda by the department, really looking at how the services were not actually meant to create or do alternative needs assessment, but really ensuring that they stick to this coordinated case management plan. And then for the qualifications, we looked at how JSP requires case workers to have minimum qualifications or experience of a SACS level 4 worker. So according to the industry award, employees are required to have the knowledge and skills gained through qualifications or previous experience in a discipline. So the award specifies that employees are required to hold, you know, a combination of relevant degree level or vocational training experience. However, the award is not particularly specific about what qualifications are relevant. And so I guess from the JSP side, really drilling down on this is where our analysis began for the paper that we wrote.
That's great. Thank you. Yeah, there's so many interesting bits in there. So I'll do the comparison to Flow, and that'll kind of help us go into a bit of the comparison analysis process. So in terms of the ratios for Flow, they are a 1-to-25 case management ratio. So that means a case manager has 25 young people that they look after, and that's for a 12-month period. So that's 52 weeks of the year. And as I said, there's weekly in-person contact. So anyone who's good at maths is adding up 25 hours over the week and working out how much they could reasonably get in contact with the young person. So anyway, we'll come back to that. I don't want to precuss too much. The qualifications for Flow case managers starts at a Cert 4, and then you can have a diploma in youth work, and then there are other options were Bachelor of Psychology or Bachelor of Social Work. So it's quite specific. It names qualifications as contrasting to the JSP. And then finally, the reporting requirements from Flow are fortnightly, term and semester reports. And the case manager would provide updates on the student's attendance and activities and other case management comments is how it's framed in the policy. Case managers are expected to engage with the young person within a semester in accredited learning outcomes. That's kind of the expectation in the policy there as well. So have to report back on that. And then at the end of each semester, an exit should be discussed with the Flow school-based coordinator. So they're kind of looking to see each semester if there's a space for the young person to move on from Flow. So they're quite different in each of those areas, which is interesting. It kind of poses a challenge, you know, is this really comparable? Because they seem quite different case management requirements. But, of course, the term case management is used so generically and so broadly, it shows that this way of working with young people is quite varied as well. You know, and we can see that there would be impacts on actual quality of service delivery across these different variances. Before we launch into a little bit of analysis of these different components, I want to give just a little bit of history for case management. And so that's part of the context, I think, that our analysis comes out of as well. So it's worth knowing that case management in Australia came out of a history of the way of delivering care services in Australia. So prior to kind of the 1970s in Australia, the care of individuals with kind of high level of dependence of some sort usually took place within sort of public institutions. So here we're often thinking about, you know, mental health services, you know, the mental health asylums, that sort of thing. But in the 1980s, Australian state and federal governments kind of reviewed the mental health and disability and child welfare and even aged care services kind of recommendations. And they recommended was for deinstitutionalization, so to move away from these public institutions and shift to support people to live in the community. Now, there's lots of pros and cons to that. I'm not going to go into all of those, but that's kind of the shift that happened in the 80s. The other thing that happens around that time is a shift internationally in this deinstitutionalization, and this results in, instead of services being concentrated in one location in these institutions, they become dispersed. So there's lots of different services offering, you know, almost like a marketplace of services for people to access and to draw on at these different specialists. Around the same time as the introduction of what we talk about as new public management, so this is a way of managing government service delivery instead of, again, the government delivering all those services through these institutions. They become the funder of services. The government is the funder of services, and community services and other services provide that funded by government. So again, this is quite a deliberate outsourcing and market creation idea. And recently, this was really reinforced to me. I went and had a conversation with some people who were in a government department delivering some services, and we were talking about this new contract that they were developing. And the contracts person talked to me quite enthusiastically about how they were creating a market of competitive service providers, and that this was a good thing from their perspective. And so this isn't just like an accident. This is quite deliberate, this strategy of working, and it has some very important effects on service delivery. So that's kind of the next question for us, is to think about what is all this ratio, you know, that we talked about, funding, marketization, what does this mean for actually delivering case management services? What does this mean for practitioners? Take us into a little bit of the analysis that we did.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, you know, thinking about the comment from that practitioner that you recently talked to, we're sitting in a good position here where we can be critical and have a critical lens on this. But, you know, I do want to acknowledge, you know, so people don't come at me with pitchforks, that it is, you know, these are people's jobs. On the flip side of it, it is young people as well that we are meant to be servicing. So, you know, it's a really hard thing to negotiate as people are putting these programs together or thinking about funding requirements and that kind of stuff as well. So I do want to acknowledge that before we kind of, you know, get into it. This critical work should be done because, you know, as I'm sure you'll be teaching your students, Ben, it's important that this critical work is done for policy frameworks.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
So look, yeah, when we were looking at some of the analysis we did around case management, particularly around the caseloads, we looked at how caseloads assume that this social issue or the young people have relatively simple and individualistic lifestyles. And I would also probably go a step further, which I don't think we kind of drew out a lot in our paper, but it's a really class-based way of thinking about young people. So it's a way of thinking about young people where their problem, and I, you know, if we were recording this as a video, you'd see my air quotes there, can be solved by supporting the young person to make small but rapid changes in their lives. Now, you know, we know that from decades of research that, you know, these small and rapid changes really take time. They're not rapid at all. And so what we argued was this approach aligns well with how problems are imagined within this kind of individual responsibility discourse of neoliberal social policy. However, you know, what we also argued was that this really runs counter to the complex understandings of disadvantage that really underpin human service professions.
Yeah, that's perfect. And I think that's a really important point about the imagination of problems, right? So this is a key framework that we talk to my students again about in my social policy topics, which is how is a problem represented? You know, the social problems are complicated and they have many, many facets to them, but they're represented in a way in policy. And one way to identify how they're represented is to look at some of these, I think Carol Backey calls them concrete proposals. So, you know, what's actually being delivered. And if you're delivering a service that is short term, like the 12 weeks, or even like a year, right? The year is a relatively short term time frame to address complex social problems. If you're delivering that and in a way that is about working one to one with an individual, and it's about working, as in the case with Flo, 1 hour a week, you're essentially saying the problem is, like you said, small, fixable. The individual is responsible for doing that, and then this is all we need to change that problem. Mm. So that becomes quite clear when you look at the combination of different features of this case management service.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, drawing out two things that I'm kind of side issues here that really relate to that and how the problem's seen. You know, I mentor young people as they're coming out of juvenile justice. What was offered to one of these young people was a pathway into a traineeship or an apprenticeship. However, in order to be eligible for this program, they had to have had employment for a certain period of time.
Right.
You know, they're just coming out of juvenile justice. Like, why are they being offered this service where they have to have, I think it was like a minimum of 6 months casual employment? You know, so we can have a look at different things like that as well about, yeah, what the problem is, but also, you know, these problems are so complex and are really rooted in social policy or in the ways we think about neoliberalism or young people or, you know, all of those kind of things.
Yeah, correct. So there can end up being this disconnect between what young people's lives are actually like versus the service that we fund, because we imagine a problem in a way and we fund the service in that way, but doesn't actually meet their real lives, which I think is an important part of the maybe even just the reporting requirements that are happening in these case management services, because in theory, you know, these services are outsourced to these non-government services, and they have, I think one of the ideas we talk about is like the freedom to manage that service, right? So they can deliver it however they like, they can deliver it in context. But when you drill down into the reporting requirements, you see there's actually not a lot of freedom there at all. Like in your case with the JSP, you said they weren't able to do alternative needs assessments. So they kind of have to just go with the existing one. And there are layers of reporting required to happen. So you spend a lot of time doing that reporting. And so if we think about what this means for practitioners as well, is, you know, they imagine themselves as practitioners delivering services, right? I don't imagine personally that there's many social workers who come in to study social work at Flinders going, I'm just really looking forward to the report writing bit of it. They're probably not imagining that being a significant part of their time. But under these reporting expectations, it is. Mm. So how much freedom do they actually have to do that stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the way you segued me back onto topic there, Ben. Thank you for that. Yeah, but look, you know, the reporting requirements is a really key element to this because, you know, those high reporting requirements really limit the capacity for NGOs and workers, youth workers, to really engage in the critical practice that, you know, you and I take for granted that we're doing at the moment. And so really, and I guess what we argued as well in our paper is it produces a youth service sector that dedicates a significant proportion of their time to self-regulation and compliance.
Yeah, Absolutely. And this is just if they've already got a funding arrangement of some sort, whether it be a grant or a tender, let alone all the ones you have to apply for that you never get as well, and reporting back on those. So there's a huge amount of paperwork involved in these kind of services when that's, like you say, not exactly what the people imagine themselves doing. The other part that links into that for me is kind of the qualification standards, right? So you were talking about the purpose and the necessity for this critical reflection. And again, we have this great privilege of being able to do it. But there are some qualifications that kind of teach that, and there are others that don't. And they usually are just reflective of the kind of level or picture of what the practitioner will be doing at the end of the day as well. So, you know, if you've got vet level qualifications, you know, certificates, diplomas, they're designed to get people into practice as quick as possible. That's kind of the nature of it. So there's not a lot of space in them to teach this critical reflective process. Instead, it's fairly sort of narrow behavioralist competency based training. Now, that's not saying there's no value in that. I'm just saying it's missing this critically reflective part. So when you've got something like flow, where you can have one of four qualifications and there's a cert four and a degree listed in them, you're creating a false level of equivalence between those two. And similarly in JSP, I think from memory, it's not specified which ones. So again, there's just this blurry lines between the ways that we train people for this kind of work. Takes me back to what you were talking about at the start in your PhD. You were saying about the subjectivities or identities that people bring to their work. What were the qualifications of the people that you interviewed in your PhD? Did they have a varying, or were they mostly the same?
Yeah, look, they were quite varied, and in particular in that one service where we kind of are drilled down at looking at this, they were varied between university level or TAFE level qualifications. But I guess the interesting thing there is regardless of the level of qualification, they still emphasize their individual knowledges. So, you know, the particular person who I said taught the young people about deportment, if I remember correctly, that was a diploma level qualification, whereas the person who had who talked about their brother being in JJ's, that was a university degree. And if I remember correctly, that was actually a nursing degree.
So part of our argument is that in these different qualifications, there are different imaginations of who the practitioner is, but also who the young people are. So we argue that there is a difference there. But also, your PhD is saying in practice that doesn't actually work out. Like there might be a difference in training, but maybe there's something about what it means to actually work in this space and work under some of the ratios and recording requirements that kind of squashes, again, that capacity for critical reflection.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think I've actually, like, I don't know whether my PhD work or the, you know, the work that I've done since then actually really drew that out to a way that really gets the point of critical reflection. I mean, I obviously looked at it within that work and have looked at it since, but I still think there's a lot of work to be done there to really draw out those complexities with that. And, you know, some work that I'll be doing in the coming months, hopefully we'll be able to do more of that.
Yeah, great. Okay. That's really interesting. I'm thinking there's so much more I want to ask you about that, but we should probably get towards a wrapping up sort of point. Is there anything other than, or maybe just even reinforcing this, like the importance of critical reflection, that you would say for people who are wanting to become a practitioner in this space? You know, what's something that they can take away and think about, hey, I'm going to be a practitioner, I should remember?
That's a good question. Yeah, I feel like you've put me on the spot here.
I have absolutely put you on the spot, so I'm sorry for doing that.
All right. Look, what I would say is, you know, and what I say to my own students who are becoming criminal justice practitioners, particularly when we're talking about, you know, these were some of the conversations that we had last semester when we were in my youth justice course, when we were talking about what you learn within the classroom as opposed to what happens in the real world when you are, you know, fighting for funding and that sort of thing. And I guess my only piece of advice to them is to really reflect back on what you did learn and try and remember that and take that into your work so that you can maintain those knowledges and understandings. And I guess do your best when you are thinking about funding requirements or getting funding or bidding or putting in tenders and those sort of things.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, man. I appreciate that, you know, throughout this, you've put in that qualifier that says, you know, we've got this privilege of reflecting on this, but in practice, it's actually really hard, right? It's not just as easy as we kind of make it out to be in this conversation. Oh, you really shouldn't do that. But it reminds me of a story where I was working as a practitioner and I was delivering a service. It wasn't case management. It was like a program of sorts. And my organization decided that they were going to run that in a local school. And I had some issues with just the way that kind of been set up. And I won't go into great detail about it, but essentially the young people weren't voluntary part of this program when they usually would be. Mm. And I raised that issue and said, look, this program works best when young people are voluntary, not mandated. And the answer was, well, this is a business imperative. Yeah, we've got to do this because we need a good relationship with that school. We need to have the income for it. We need to have an ongoing role for you and some other people. And all of those are good reasons. You know, they're not the only reason to do something. And you know, we've critiqued that and criticized that heavily. But bringing what you've learned while you're studying into that space to have an opportunity for critical reflection, I think is a really, really great takeaway message.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think there's simple solutions or simple answers either. Like you asked me what they can take away or, you know, when I was talking to my own students about, you know, these complexities when they do get into the field, I really don't think there are simple answers, simple solutions, easy solutions, or necessarily right or wrong. And I guess that goes back to that idea of positive deviance that I'm thinking about at the moment. But I would probably say is just thinking critically is what we can teach practitioners going into the field so that even if they have to make these tough decisions, they can see the complexities or both sides of the coin, so to speak. You know, so they can say, okay, well, I am making this decision within this framework, but I will make the best possible decisions I can make within the framework.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, man. I think that's a really important takeaway. It reminds me that, you know, simple solutions are often highly individualistic and it's kind of your fault. Whereas if you remember that you're part of a broader structure and a policy framework and there's a whole bunch of competing interests, you know, it's not just about you making a right or wrong decision. I'll make one other quick connection to a broader theme in this podcast and in the topics that I'm teaching, which is this idea that social policy makes and breaks social work and human services work and vice versa. So we can see here how the policy frameworks and the economic frameworks and the culture frameworks that we work in have a huge influence over what we can actually do as practitioners as well. So that idea of it making and breaking our work is really strong. All right, before we wrap up, tell me about anything that you're working on at the moment that you'd really like to spruik. Is there anything you're developing? You've already told us a bit about the positive deviance idea.
Yeah, so look, I always love a bit of shameless self-promotion, as all academics do. Yeah. But to be honest, I'm in a kind of a liminal space at the moment where I've changed institutions and I'm finishing up a couple of projects and starting a couple. So they're a project that I have been working on for the last couple of years is Name, Narrate, Navigate. So a preventative intervention program focused on pseudo-education and skill development for young people who are at increased risk of using violence or those who are already using violence in their interpersonal, family, domestic relationships, and looking at cross-sector support and work that can be provided. So there is an open access report that's available and I can maybe give that to you, Ben, so you can put that in the show notes or provide that to your students.
Yes, please.
And we've also got a book coming in 2022 that, yeah, so kind of a watch this space there. I've also been working on a project with Nova for Women and Children in Newcastle to develop an assertive outreach model for women and children in the Hunter region. So again, that's a watch this space. There's kind of the data collection is wrapping up with that. The model is currently being developed, but there's no work out there at the moment. And as I said, I'm starting a project looking at the voluntary sector in the criminal justice system and really focusing on mentoring to build some of those themes that I raised within my PhD. And I am starting another project, which I can't give any details about, but I'm really excited about it. But it's looking at the intersections of care and violence and aggression.
Wow. That sounds great. A few projects coming out there soon, and a little bit of a teaser of something else you're working on. If people wanted to keep updated, keep tabs on what you're doing, and you know, a little bit of stalking on the internet or whether, where's the easiest place to find you?
Yeah, probably Twitter. So my handle is Joel R. McGregor. Generally, I use Twitter as kind of a central repository for work that I'm doing and a link sharing and all of that kind of stuff.
Perfect. All right. And we'll provide some links to that as well in the show notes. This is great, man. Thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it. I've had a lot of fun.
That's right.
We'll have to get you back on when you have some of those new projects come out as well.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you so much for having me, and good luck to your students for this semester. And, you know, if you use this podcast in the coming years, for them as well.
Awesome. Thanks, man. We'll talk again soon.
All right. Thank you.
This episode was edited by Ryan Manhire, music by Anthem of Rain, sourced from the freemusicarchive.org. You can find me, Ben, on Twitter, @LohmeyerBen. If you like the podcast, please like, share, comment, and do all the things.